This episode of Awards Chatter is brought to you by Universal Television, presenting Girls 5 Eva. Girls 5 Eva follows a one-hit wonder 90s girl group who attempts a comeback while hilariously navigating family and relationships, plus the joys and pains of middle age. The show stars Sarah Bareilles, Renee Elise Goldsberry, Paul Appel, and Busy Phillips. Don't miss the series critics call the funniest show on television. Girls 5 Eva is now streaming on Netflix and is for your Emmy consideration for Outstanding Comedy Series and all other eligible categories.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 241st episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a living legend of music and film who, over the course of a career spanning some 75 years, has worked as a musician, arranger, orchestrator, conductor, record producer, film composer, record label executive, film producer, and humanitarian, closely collaborating with an incredible array of the most important artists of his time, including Ray Charles, Clark Terry, Lionel Hampton, Dizzy Gillespie, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Frank Sinatra, Leslie Gore, Sidney Lumet, Michael Jackson, Steven Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, and Will Smith. Along the way, he also became one of only 21 EGOTs, meaning a winner of at least one Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony, if you count not only competitive awards like his Emmy, Tony, and 27 Grammys, which are tied with Alison Krauss for the most among people still living and second most overall, and non-competitive awards like the special Oscar, the Gene Herschel Humanitarian Award, that the Film Academy presented him in 1995, to go along with two special Grammys, 1989's Trustees Award and 1992's Legend Award. He's also a 2013 inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and a recipient of its Lifetime Achievement Award. His friends call him Q, but the world knows him as the incomparable Quincy Jones. Over the course of our conversation at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills, the 85-year-old and I discussed a wide range of topics, including how he was shaped by his dark childhood, how he first began playing music professionally while he was still in his teens, what it was like being black in Hollywood and abroad as he was building his career, how he reinvented himself in so many different areas of the entertainment industry over the years, and what motivated him later in his career to champion up-and-coming talent like Jackson, Winfrey, and Smith, what he thinks of the state of music and America today, and what he makes of Quincy, the acclaimed new documentary feature about his life and career. But first, I was joined at the Four Seasons by Al Hicks and Rashida Jones, the co-directors of the aforementioned documentary Quincy, which had its world premiere on September 9th at the Toronto International Film Festival, receiving a huge standing ovation, which has since had its American premieres in New York and L.A., garnering the same response, and which debuted on Netflix last Friday. Al and Rashida, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Cheers.
So, Al, let's start with you if we can. I don't know if people caught it in that one word there, but they'll know from your accent you are Australian. What brought you to America and specifically to filmmaking?
Yeah, I'm from Australia. I'm from a town called Wollongong, south of Sydney, about an hour and a half south of Sydney. And I grew up as a drummer or musician. And I was really interested in jazz and moved to New York when I was 18 to pursue jazz and study music.
You got a scholarship to go there, right?
Yes. Yeah, I got a scholarship to go to a university called William Patterson University just outside of New York City when I was 18. And yeah, I went on and ended up playing drums in the band of the great Clark Terry, the trumpet player.
Who had also been a teacher many years earlier of Quincy Jones.
Right? Yeah, Quincy Jones and Miles Davis. Anyways, I, through some crazy circumstances, ended up meeting him and becoming friends and eventually joining his band and played with him for 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I felt this whole thing that maybe we should be filming Clark because he's one of the last living legends from that time and nobody had done anything. So I switched gears and started making a film about him.
And Keep On Keeping On came out in 2014, won the Audience Award and the Best New Documentary Director Award at the 2014 Tribeca Film Festival. And it was in the course of making that that I think you first crossed paths with Quincy Jones. And I guess we have Snoop Dogg's broken ankle to thank for
oh, yeah.
really. Like, can you explain how this movie might not be happening? Quincy might not be happening without Snoop Dogg.
Well, in Keep On Keeping On, there was a moment where Quincy literally walks into the film, and he was coming down to Arkansas to record with Clark Terry, who was going to sing his trademark mumbles, he calls it, and Snoop Dogg was going to rap with him. So Quincy was coming down to produce that session and to also hang out with his teacher. And Snoop Dogg was playing basketball with his son in the driveway before going to the airport and sprained his ankle and didn't come. And so it was just kind of fate that Quincy was already on the flight and just spent the day hanging out with Clark and met Clark's student, who's a blind piano player, Justin Coughlin. And then Quincy took a liking to Justin's playing and they became friends, and he eventually signed Justin, who was also the other main character in that in Keep On Keeping On.
And Quincy then came on as an executive producer, right, of Keep On, and you guys, that was the beginning of that. Rashida, people know you best as an actress, obviously. Was directing something that you've always wanted to do more of, or was it specifically because you wanted to help tell your father's story that you are now directing this film?
Well, directing's certainly been something I've been interested in, and I've directed a couple episodes of my show and an episode of a doc series that I created with two other women, Hot Girls Wanted Turned On.
Yes.
But I had never done anything feature length, and I think it probably took something as personal as this to help me take this scary jump to this. So, yeah, I mean, it was sort of both.
And I know that, you know, your father has said that, you know, through coming to know Al over the course of the last few years, he has great affection and trust for him. But also, I wonder, he probably takes the confidence that somebody has in a child to move forward with something like this, right? Do you think, you know, how important was it to him that you would also be anchoring this story and wanted him to do it?
Well, when I first mentioned to him that I wanted to make a documentary, he was very excited. I think there's, like, you know, a nice synergy. First, you're proud of your kid. And then also, my dad is he's a true purist extrovert. I mean, he really is the definition of that world. He gets energy from other people. And I think, you know, having a crew around him and having people he trusts, yes, very important, but having a crew around him and being able to kind of, you know, charm the camera while he charms other people, letting people into his life, like, that is something that's kind of a core value for him as a human being. So it definitely helped in terms of us having access and also telling a story that wasn't always, you know, the positive best representation of him at any given time. I think, you know, it took a kind of a special team to do that.
Well, and because he's had such a jam-packed long life with so many different chapters, was there ever any consideration to doing what has become increasingly a popular thing to do, docu-series, something like what we saw with an O.J. Made in America or any of the, you know, it's just, there's tons of them now. Or was it always important to you guys to do it as a feature-length documentary?
I mean, the truth is there's absolutely enough footage to do many, many seasons of a docuseries. He's got a big old life, and, you know, luckily we had access to so much archival material. But I think from the very beginning, it was important to tell the story as a feature film, because I think that's the kind of time frame that people can absorb. And then also, there's so much other richness to his life that if it's just a jumping off point. So you start with the movie, and then you can go dig a little deeper if you want. But it's always been important to me to make the film version.
And it's kind of amazing. I looked, there had, I think, been one other documentary, Listen Up, or something, but nobody's really, I think it was so daunting to other people to try to tell his story that they just really haven't done it. It's like Clark, in the sense that nobody's really told his story on film before.
Well, I think part of it is that my dad, he's so accomplished. So you're so busy listing his accomplishments that it's really hard to ever get the time to talk about his personal life and his emotional life.
Right.
But for us, there is a synergy between his emotional life and his success. It's not like they're two different things. It's not like he presents one way and then he's another way at home.
Right.
The way that he connects with people, the way that he creates these bonds and friendships in the course of 2 hours of meeting someone or whatever it is, it's the same energy and talent that he has pulling out the greatest things from the artists that he works with, you know, and his workaholism and being out in the world. All those passions are connected, and that was, like, you know, an important part of the storytelling.
Well, and that's why I think the structure of the film is so effective that, you know, if you just tried to do a linear chronological thing, I think people would just be overwhelmed and not necessarily enlightened, because he is still doing it, obviously. And so the fact that you guys chose to cut back and forth between the past at different points and his life since you started filming in 2015, I think that was pretty interesting. When did you arrive at that idea, Al?
Well, it was part of some of the first discussions that we had about, before we'd even knew what kind of archival was out there, mm-hmm. was that we did want a relationship between the present and the past, and to be able to focus on his personality and to draw that out and to see moments that we can fall backwards in time that are motivated by the present. And once we dived into the archival footage, it was really evident that this is something we could do and really go for it.
Can you just fill people in on how much archival footage we're talking about, as well as how much new footage?
Yeah, so it's 800 hours of Verite footage, of like current day footage, which on Keep On Keeping On we shot 450 hours, and that was a huge undertaking, but we close to doubled it on this one. And then we found 2,000 hours of archival footage to draw from.
And where was that?
Well, he had this archive in his, kind of in the basement of his home, and we worked in there for about 6 months to go through the whole thing, scanning all the photos and lots of VHS tapes and transferring everything. And we finally finished that and went and talked to Quincy and said, "Hey, man, we finished through the archive." And he's like, "Oh, that's beautiful, but you should see the vault." And we're just like, "Oh, my God."
What was in there?
The vault is really where, you know, he...
Vault was serious.
Yeah, a lot more. it's in freezing temperatures. You have to wear all your snowboarding gear.
Oh, my God. Did you know this existed, Rashida?
I knew that there was probably some stuff that hadn't been attended to for a while, but I don't think I had any clue, especially because through the lens of wanting things to share with the world, it's completely different, you know, because you're getting into all these things that had never been seen before, and footage from so long ago, like raw tapes from specials that aired in different countries, like just incredible, incredible stuff.
So it sounds like a lot of this was new to you too. I mean, what were the most eye-opening discoveries that you came across, whether or not they made it into the film?
I just love, honestly, I love seeing all the stuff of him young, because, you know, I appeared as a child halfway through my dad's life, and he had lived this really big life before he ever got to me. I'm the sixth of seven kids.
Right.
So to see footage of him playing in Lionel Hampton's band is amazing at 18. To see him working on scores in the 60s is incredible, because I've never seen that in life. I've never seen that in motion. So
who was capturing all this footage? I mean, to me, it was more a product of the home video camera age that most of us have VHSs and stuff at home. But, like, we're talking stuff from the 50s, the 60s.
Yeah, it's from all over the place, you know. And there's things in there that there's the Super 8 footage that we found that's family home footage.
And
where
my mom had a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there was Peggy's archive as well.
Yeah.
That was another layer. But then there's stuff that has never seen the light of day. Like, there's some Ray Charles interviews and some Frank Sinatra interviews that when we first showed the movie to Quincy, these are things he's never heard before, and these are his friends, and they're long since gone, and they're speaking about him, almost to him.
Yeah.
And that was very emotional for Quincy, you know, the first time that he saw it. And that was just sitting in a vault.
Would you guys sort of, since a lot of this research had to happen in his home in Bel Air, are you guys, you know, letting him know when you make various discoveries, or was it all just sort of sprung on him at the end?
He sort of wanted it that way. He said, just let me know when you're done.
When it's over,
which
yeah.
is the best news you can
yeah.
ever hear from a subject.
Yeah.
Because
oh, yeah.
there's nothing worse than a micromanaging
right,
subject.
Right. Which, when it's family, families micromanage each
exactly.
other all the time.
Exactly.
So speaking of that aspect of things, as his daughter, what for you, Rashida, was the hardest thing to not be able to put in there to share with the world? And what was the hardest thing to have to put in there to share with the world?
Well, I think probably the hardest thing not to put in is just all the stuff that didn't make it in, because mm-hmm. his story is so big, you know, and we had to make pretty tough decisions about how to edit this particular story. There's so many other stories to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say the hardest thing to put in was the thing that I think we had to put in, which was footage of him not doing well, mm-hmm. you know, in the hospital, mm-hmm. having health stuff, because I am protective of him, but I also know that you can't tell a real story unless you have all the information in there. And of course, like, there's, you know, you make these editorial decisions about what kind of story to tell, but the story of his life is, whether or not he can see it every day, he pushes himself to the edge,
mm-hmm.
and then he kind of like sobers up, you know, sometimes literally, sometimes just psychologically,
right.
and then he pushes on the next decade and does a bunch of work, and then he has the same pattern again.
Yeah.
And because he's incredibly strong on every level, he's managed to do that so many more times than should even be real,
right.
you know. But I wanted to show the world that, and I wanted to show him that,
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of that stuff that he wasn't even conscious for, he couldn't even see. So, you know, it's important to tell the whole story.
Yeah. And Al, in the course of doing this, was there something that you came to learn or better appreciate about Quincy that you didn't know before? I mean, you're obviously much more knowledgeable about music and I'm sure about Quincy than your average guy on the street, but still, to get this deep into it, what were the biggest revelations to you?
Oh, man. Well, it's Quincy Jones. You know, so you find out something new every day, whether you're actually filming with him or you're in the archive. So he's constantly telling stories. And if you film him for a full day, it all makes sense. But if the people that are just getting in front of him, he's in the middle of talking through a story and that person might leave and the next
right.
person comes and he continues it. And
it's like jazz.
Yeah, he's totally improvising. But to be recording that throughout the day, you can see that, like, there is just such a rich history there and he just wants to share it.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the archive is concerned, there's things like just finding out that he had the first music that was ever played on the moon.
Mm-hmm. Fly Me to the Moon.
Fly Me to the Moon.
Appropriately.
Yeah. Finding out that he was in the room standing next to the piano with John Coltrane when Miles Davis recorded Kinda Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And Quincy's like 23 years old. He's just there. But not just there as like a young kid. He's a major mm-hmm. arranger in the city. He's
mm-hmm.
a very at the top. To see that he could climb this ladder, this creative ladder in different aspects of music, and then further into production and filmmaking, he became a trumpet player. His first thing is he wanted to play the trumpet. He rose up in that, and then he decided he wanted to be an arranger, and he rose up to the top of that. Then he decided he wanted to write for strings. He rose up to the top in that. Film scores. You know, it just keeps... And this is all before Michael Jackson.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. I could talk for hours about the surprises you find out about a person like that.
Definitely. I thought one of the most interesting creative decisions you guys made was to not do what we see in most documentaries about, you know, people with such rich lives, and that is to not show any talking head interviews. We don't see anybody, whether it's the subject or people who knew him, going on and giving us exposition. I'm sure it didn't make your lives easier, so why did you choose to do that?
I think it was an important stylistic choice we agreed upon really early in the process, because this is an intimate movie and we wanted it to feel first person. And the way to do that is to not make it feel academic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens when I watch movies with talking heads.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I like it,
yeah.
But for this, you know, we wanted it to stay visceral. We wanted it to stay emotional. We wanted it to stay intimate. And we had such great audio from, you know, not just my dad, but all the people in his life and surrounding his life. So we thought if we can just create enough visuals to support the audio, that you could stay in a zone easier.
And I think was there a model for this in terms of other docs that you wanted to emulate?
Well, there is some films that have done that. Senna.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Amy. Yeah.
Amy.
He's such a wonderful filmmaker.
Carpedia,
yeah.
And it's a more complicated way to go about it, too. the construction becomes more complicated. But what we were hoping to do is that in each era to find as much audio from Quincy from that period so that it's not a retrospective right. story. As we get into the 60s, he's in the 60s and he's talking about that time. As we get into the 70s, he's talking about that time right. while it's happening. So we try to do that as much as possible.
Yeah, and not many people have had their lives documented enough to do that where yeah. you could go. So that's pretty interesting. I guess lastly, what was it like for you guys to show the film finally after all these years of working on it to him, and what was his reaction?
Well, we were definitely nervous. Yeah. I mean, of course, yeah. you know, it's a long time coming. And also you get more into your process and you wonder if the person who the process is about is going to see what you see and all that stuff. And that's true for anybody mm-hmm. who sees the film. But he was there for the ride. I mean, he cried, he laughed, and he said after he saw the film, which is like a hilarious reaction because anybody watches that film and it makes them feel lazy. It makes them feel like they right. want to get up the next morning right. and maybe try to do something that's right. a little less less than sleeping in their bed. Right. But he said, I wish I could live forever.
He still got the juice.
I yeah. mean, that's he is a true one of a kind. And I think seeing him react to the film is emblematic of that because who the hell would say that after seeing the mind-blowing accomplishments and life that he's lived? Like, who would say that?
That's true. Al, anything you'd add?
Well, I was nervous, man, because there's just a lot of stuff in there that you think that he wouldn't like. There's a yeah. lot of stuff, that, yeah. you know, that's you're like, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. And he'd given us this license to be able to just freely create this movie. And he hadn't seen it. And we're just like, oh, my goodness. And then he just went totally into it. Thankfully, he really liked the movie.
Yeah, and thankfully, that's also been the predominant response here so far as you guys have rolled it out in New York and LA. And congratulations, and thank you for doing this. Appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thanks, Scott.
And now for my interview with the man himself, Quincy Jones.
All right, Mr. Jones, thank you so much for doing this, and congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you.
We always begin by just asking all of our guests to share, and obviously a lot of this is addressed in the film, but where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Chicago, Illinois, 1933. Nightmare.
Yeah.
Everybody, I hear people complaining about the 60s, 70s, 80s. They should try the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, right after the Depression, yeah. And your folks?
My father was a master carpenter. He worked with a gang. He was an architect for the most notorious gangsters in America, the Jones Boys. We're doing a movie on him now. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my mother was a graduate from Boston University, very smart lady, but she had dementia praecox. And we were 7 years old. They took her away in a straitjacket, and that was not fun.
No, we see in the documentary how much that affected you. And how do you think another thing affected you from your childhood, and that's poverty? I mean, it was not easy for a lot of years there,
right? The 30s during the Depression.
Yeah.
And there's something in the water in Chicago that creates gangsters. I don't know what it is. I mean, think of Rahm Emanuel, Pat Daly Sr.
Right.
Giacomo. I mean, they don't play Capone.
No. And so you were heading in that direction yourself, right, when
oh,
music
yeah.
came
11
along.
Years, man, because you want to be what you see. And I learned, all I saw, dead bodies every day, and Tommy guns and stogies and piles of money, and it was amazing.
And so really it was kind of just a fateful thing between your mother singing, your neighbor playing the piano, and then you doing a naughty thing, but that led you to a piano, right, that really kind of saved the day.
Yeah, that turned my life around. I'd have been dead or in prison mm-hmm. if I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
Thank God he stepped up.
What do you think it was about music or musicians or the life of people in the music business? What was it that appealed to you about it all at first?
Well, you know, I didn't know how to answer that before, but when we were doing Roots, Alex Haley asked me where my music roots came from. And I didn't know, really. And so he went and talked to a lady named Johnny Cerny, who was a Mormon, Salt Lake City, one of the smartest ladies. He got a book on my family for $1,000, and I went back and got 39 more.
Wow.
Got all of the information of what happened. Because, you know, the black families don't want to tell you what really happened. Because my first aunts were coal black, but my grandmother was an ex-slave, you know. And then my three aunts were high yellow, and daddy had straight hair using Vitalis. Brothers didn't use Vitalis. Mm-hmm. Using conch.
Yeah.
Processor. Anyway, It's an amazing journey.
People these days, you know, if you talk about Seattle and music, they're thinking about grunge and they're thinking about alternative rock and all
Kurt,
that.
Kurt Cobain.
Kurt Cobain, right, yeah. And Pearl right. Jam. But the reality is, long before Kurt Cobain was a figment of his mother's imagination, your family moved to the Seattle area, right?
After Bremerton.
Right. So what was going on musically in Seattle when you got there?
Everything. That's when I met Ray Charles.
And you were
met Ray Charles at 17. I was 14.
Yeah.
He taught me how to read music in Braille. He had sight till he was 6, you know, and I spent his whole life with him till he left us, you know.
And Seattle is where you first discovered
on
jazz.
Fire.
Yeah.
We'd play the Seattle Tennis Club, which was all white. We'd wear white cardigans and bow ties and play pop music, to each his own and all that stuff. And then we'd go to Washington Social Club, which is a black club, and we'd change our clothes, play for strip teasers and rhythm and blues, you know, T-Bone Walker.
How young were you when somebody first wanted to hire you to work for them as a musician, as a trumpeter, I think, right?
Well, I was always working as a trumpeter with Bumps Blackwell. We worked with Billie Holiday, at Bumps Blackwell's band, when we were 14.
Right. So this was
Billy
like
Eckstein at 15.
Early.
I met Clint Eastwood during those days. His family moved from Oakland to go to work at Bowings, you know, and he used to come by the Trianon Ballroom every night because jazz is always girls there.
Right.
You know,
so
my nickname for him is Albino Red.
But it was in Seattle that you first got kind of recruited by Lionel Hampton.
Well, he wanted me to go with his band when I was 15.
Right.
Because somebody played in one of my arrangements. I wrote a suite from the Four Winds.
Right.
And he heard it, and he wanted me right away. And I got on the band bus. I didn't even ask my parents and stepmother. I just got on the bus. I didn't want anything to get come between it. And I sat on there by myself for 5 hours. Then all the band got on, and Hamp got on, and his wife Gladys, who managed the band, said, his nickname was Gates. He said, "Gates, what's that child doing back there? Come here, honey." I said, "Oh, God." I was so mad, man. And she said, "What's your name?" I said, "Da-da-da-da-da-da. How old are you?" 15. "Get off the bus. Go get your education." Oh, man, I was so broken. I can't tell you. And sure enough, I didn't like the curriculum at the Seattle University. We had a scholarship. It was too proper. Mm-hmm. So I got a scholarship to the Schillinger House, which now is the Berklee School of Music. I hurried back there, stopped in Chicago to see my relatives and went back there.
Yeah, so when you were now done with that at 18, you could now go off with...
And Hamp called me. He called 6 months later. I left that school so quick, man. Quick.
Well, drugs have really messed with a lot of people in the music business who you've known.
It goes with bebop, man.
Well, that's what I want to get to, because I think you've said that, you know, obviously it's affected a lot of people who you've crossed paths with over the years. And when you were with the Hampton band, I think I came across a past interview. I think you were saying that Malcolm X was the dealer for the band.
He was in front of the Majestic Hotel in Detroit. We used to call him Detroit Red.
And
have his Italian suits on. That's what when Spike Lee did Malcolm X, I said, "Man, Malcolm could walk around in a blue zoot suit marching down the street. You know, he's a dope dealer, man."
But there was so that was one person who, just to give an example of different people, you obviously you've said, you know, Ray Charles, who you'd known again for
30
years already.
30 years of heroin.
Yeah. I mean, it got bad for him with, I guess, heroin in particular. So my point is, how did you manage to avoid the pitfalls that affected so many other people around you?
But he kept me hooked for 5 months at 15. After we'd finished the Washington Social Club and a couple of other ones, we all go down to Jackson Street to the Elks Club. That's where all the bebop jam sessions were. Nobody got paid. We didn't give a damn. So the guys, when they finished playing, they'd go over in a corner. Ray wouldn't let me get in the corner. And they had it on their thumb, you know, right there. And a year later, I just snuck in the line and got me a little hit.
I read it was really only because a pretty dangerous thing happened to you that you got out of that.
Yeah, I fell down 5 flights of steps.
How does that happen?
For a trumpet, just high.
Yeah.
But that's not good for a trumpet player. And I was over. And you know what? The mistakes are what helped you grow and learn.
Yeah.
That was a big one. And if I hadn't done that, I would have been in New York when I was hanging out with Charlie Parker. I would have been a junkie forever.
Right.
A bird was always high.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God we did it there and got it over with.
I think outside of the music business, people aren't totally sure what being an arranger means. It's something
I know they don't.
Right? And I want to ask you, because it was something that I guess the first time you were really hired to do it was...
Started with Oscar Pettiford. Okay. That's the first time in New York, you know, and I got to meet Meade, Lux, Lewis, and all those people.
So what does it mean to be an arranger, and why do you think you are so good at it?
Orchestration, to me, is like heaven. Mm-hmm. It really is. How do you take four trumpets, four trombones, five saxophones, two altos, two tenors, the baritone? Somebody came to that conclusion. Benny Carter and Don Redman explained to me how they came there, because the saxophone was invented by Adolf Sax with an E from Belgium in 1860. And the only classical composer that ever used it, all of them, sopranos, reactors, all of them, he did them. And I think Ravel's Bolero was the only one that ever used a saxophone. And he had no idea there was going to be Chu Berry and Coleman Hawkins and Coltrane and Charlie Parker and Cannonball. He had no idea. And they, you know, brothers will do anything right. So they took it to a whole other level.
So it's basically, it's being able to envision in your mind, right, how...
The collective.
Yeah, all the pieces of the puzzle.
Yes, you put them all together. And it's an amazing challenge. Because you can make it sound however you want to do it to make it yours, you know.
So what was it that enabled you to do that so well? Was it your familiarity with different
probably
instruments?
Probably no mama.
What's that?
Probably no mother, you know. And also the weather in Seattle was perfect too, because you couldn't go out because it was raining all the time. You know, so that's all I wanted to do.
What's the greatest skill that most other people don't have that you have? Is it arranging, or is it some other aspect?
Well, it's orchestration and so forth, but a lot of people have that. But I went all the way. I went back to Nadia Boulanger in Paris in 57, and she always teased me, and she said, you jazz guys are hard to deal with because you shack up with music first, then you court it and marry it later. And that's exactly what happened. I went to her to learn how to write for symphony orchestra, and so nothing would scare me, you know. All the different genres of music, Ray said, respect each genre. It's just only good and bad music. And Duke Ellington, my first production was Duke, We Love You Madly, Century City. And when we finished his thing, he died a year later, 75. And he said, on a picture you gave me, may you be the one to start to decategorize American music. The categories are worthless, you know.
Which was certainly a big thing for
Back on Block. And I did that.
Yeah.
I did that. And I got dissed a lot when I started to do Michael Jackson, because I always did all kinds of music. Laverne Baker, you know, whatever you bring, I could do it. Bebop, Sonny Stitt.
Yeah.
Oscar Pitt, all of them. Mingus, you know.
Well, that period when you worked with Nadia Boulanger was, you went to Europe first, I guess, in 56 with this mission that we see in the film State Department. I guess Adam Clayton Powell was to sort of spread the...
Dizzy Gillespie.
American culture. Dizzy Gillespie was the
and
main...
I was in the process. I was starving in New York then. And George Evakian sent me a project to write. And I was so happy because I was starving to death. Mm-hmm. And it was a 17-year-old track runner from San Francisco, managed by Helen Noga. Dizzy came to me at 22 and said, I want you to be the musical director and arranger of this band. You pick all the guys and meet me with the band, arrangements on all of the national anthems in Aleppo, Damascus, everywhere, Syria, Karachi, everywhere.
And the goal was to spread American culture in Europe?
Exactly, because it just started then, you know. It was amazing. And we used to do these broadcasts with Willis Conover and Voice of America. And the Russians used to scramble it because, you know, jazz over there meant freedom then. Even the Hungarian Revolution, I met Gabor. He was playing with Lena then. But he says he was in the army when he heard our broadcast, and it helped him get his spirits up to get through it. That feels good.
So you liked it enough to then basically relocate to Paris for the next several years, four or five years.
I went for 2 weeks. And when I was in Argentina with Dizzy's band, Lalo told me about, he said, there's a new music happening up there now. It's called the New Wave. That's what bossa nova means, you know. And we got there and it was just starting with Antonio Carlos Jobim, Astrid and Joao Gilberto. They were sitting in the front row with Sebi. Dizzy was a big part of that. Do, 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 da, da. That's his trademark of flatted fifth, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So how do you think you were shaped by that opportunity to see the world for the first time really in that way, and how did it change you?
Man, I was grinning like a fox eating sauerkraut. Unbelievable. Because I took the record back to George Ivakhin, and I said, I would very appreciate it very much, and I think he's a great singer, but I don't think he's a jazz singer. And they got Gil Evans and Johnny Carisi and those guys to do a jazz album to finish the one I was working on. And it didn't work. They released it, didn't work, and Mitch Miller took him upstairs and did Chances Are and 12th and Never with Johnny Mathis.
There you go.
Who was on fire when we got back. And he keeps saying to this day, he says, you left me for Dizzy? I said, yes.
But, I mean, it seems like one of the crazy things that was defined that period is while you're studying with Nadia in Paris, you're meeting, it sounds like, a lot of African-American people in exile. James Baldwin, Richard Wright?
Expatriates everywhere.
Right.
All of them. Dexter Gordon, Kenny Clark was in my house band, so was Don Byas and Lucky Thompson. Stephen Grappelli, who was with Django Reinhardt. It was an amazing experience, man.
But the reason they were there was because they didn't want to deal with what you had to deal with when you came back, which is even though you were now really distinguishing yourself, when you came back in the early 60s, first VP of color at a major record label, Mercury, making a hit record with Leslie Gore at that point.
They kept saying, you don't know anything about rock and roll. I said, man, bring it to me.
And also in that period, early 60s, was the beginning with Sinatra, I think. So the question, though, is even with all of that going on where you've clearly establishing yourself as a top artist, unlike the folks in Europe, though, who the expats who you were meeting, you came back to America and are being told that there are places you can't go and things that you can't do because you're black.
That's right. And you know what? We would not have had jazz if it wasn't for the French. Even during slavery at Congo Square, the Celtics were all trying to kill the drums and break up the culture and break up the families, you know. But the French, they cherished jazz. And when I went to France, I could really feel it. You know, they supported that music, man. They loved it.
And did you feel that as a person of color, you were more accepted in society?
In France, you don't think about person of colors at all.
Right. That's,
they don't either.
Right.
They just, you know, just do your thing. And if racism was in the hands of the jazz people, it would have been over 80 years ago. Can you play, sucker? That's all it is. Brown, red, black, whatever you are. Can you play?
Right.
That's why they used to call Red Rodney Albino Red, because he went down with a black band, and they had to say he was black, but he's albino. They made him sing one blues song. It was crazy back then.
Another area that, in Hollywood at least, was not really open to people of color before you.
Not really at all.
Well, no, but I want to film scoring is because other.
That's what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Prior to
wasn't
you.
Wasn't open at all.
I guess Duke Ellington had done Anatomy of a Murder,
yeah,
but that was
yeah.
it. But now you come along. How did it happen that you ended up working with Sidney Lumet on The Pawnbroker? That was the first score for you.
Lena Horne. I wrote a song for Basie called For Lena and Lenny, which is married to Lenny Hayden. And Sidney was flirting with Lena's daughter, Kale. Right. And so I was at the house a lot, and I'd see him on the floor flirting with her. And Lena told him, this is the guy to do The Pawnbroker, because I'd already done one Swedish film, Trevor the Porkit, you know. He took me in to see the film. He said, what do you think? I said, I don't think it needs music. He said, yes, it does, and you're going to do it. And it was that was an amazing experience. And I did 5 films with Sidney. And then another Sidney came in and gave me 6, Sidney Poitier.
Right, right, right.
Because he was fighting, too, because they had banned him, you know, during the McCarthy period. It's too left wing, you know. And Richard Brooks brought him back with Black Boy Jungle, you know.
And In the Heat of the Night's score, which you did, was that the first blues score of a movie in Hollywood? Had there been other blues infused? Yeah?
Brother John. Been long.
Yeah. But film scoring is like a totally different art form than what you had been doing before.
I know, but I was in art before music.
Yeah.
And I have synesthesia. What that is? I see music before I hear it. It's in colors, you know, purple, grays and stuff, before the sound comes. And that's crazy, but it works.
So you're saying that when you are thinking about, when you're reading music or when you're writing music?
I'm thinking about it, yeah. It comes in colors. And I think about that when I write, you know, with colors and the cross voicings. And remember Frank once told me he was testing me on The Best Is Yet to Come when I was 29 when I went with Frank. And he said, "Chu, I like love the arrangement, man, but that first eight is a little dense." I said, "No problem." I took all the saxophones and changed them to alto flutes, and took the trumpets all in harmony mutes. So just Tim's out, 5 minutes, let's go. He was shocked, you know, because Nelson, those guys were in their 50s, you know. I was following some heavy dudes, man. Billy May, woo! Serious, Gordon Jenkins.
When had you first learned to write music? Was that with Nadia?
No, man, I was 13.
But writing music, I know
yeah,
you can
writing,
play and you, it was by ear.
Composing and orchestrating, man, are you kidding? Yeah,
so the
composing
whole way through.
And orchestrating in.
Wow. But even as a kid, it sounded like, from one thing I read, you'd go to a movie and you could tell from the score what studio had done it?
Yeah, because Alfred Newman ruled at 20th Century Fox. His brother, Lionel Rich, was the musical supervisor there. He ruled. His influence took over every composer that worked there. Victor Young at Paramount, every composer, they followed Victor Young. Stanley Wilson at RKO. And I don't know how at 15 I can understand it, but I used to play hookers from school and spend $11 a movie down the Skid Row and just sit and watch him all day. And after a while, I could really get a good check on it. I saw what was going on. Because it's like another planet, man, you know. And there's synchronization, so there's a serious science to it. You know, every time it has to be right on that for synchronization.
You've had a lot of close calls, and I think this is shown in very powerfully in the documentary, a lot of health scares of one sort or another. It's starting with when you were back in Chicago being kind of menaced by
you
other people.
And that's right. And what was funny, I didn't really get it until I saw the movie. You know,
yeah.
You put them all together, you know,
sort of
laying out on the floor, you know, passed out, and brains and legs and back.
Were you supposed to be at Sharon Tate's house the night of the Manson murders?
Yes. What happened while I was doing the score to Bullet, I got pulled off of it because I had an appendectomy, and so did the assistant producer. And they gave it to Lalo Schifrin. And I was really bummed because I had to cut it loose. So first McQueen movie. He asked me, would I take Jay Sebring, who was my barber, to see a rough cut of the thing for Peter Yates, you know? And I asked him, he said, yeah. So I went with him to the screening. He had the same suit, red, yet loved the jacket and everything. He said, I'd like you to meet me tonight at Sharon's house. There's a thing up there tonight. I've got some stuff for your head for the follicles there, you know? So I'm trying to grow some stuff back, you know? And I forgot about it. And the next morning at 9 o'clock, I get a call from London in Connor Square, like where my son was born. Victor Lowndes, Cosby was staying with Victor Lowndes. He said, did you hear about J.C. Ring? He said, he's dead. I said, no way, man. He was with me last night and stuff like that. And we stopped talking, and I called Sebring International. They said, who's this calling? I said, can I speak to J.C. Ring? Who's this calling? Da, 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 da. J.C. Ring's dead. Bam! And I turned TV on, and I knew that house backwards because I tried to buy it, you know. And Rudy Altobelli would only rent it to me. He wouldn't sell it, you know. Do you know the story behind that, how Manson got all freaked out? Terry Melcher, that's Doris Day's son, was there with Candy Bergen. And he was producing the Beach Boys. And Manson came during that time and asked him, could he give him a record deal? And he just pushed him away. And so he said, go kill the pigs on the hill. But they weren't there anymore because it was Sharon Tate and Polanski, you know.
Wow.
But Polanski wasn't in town. We saw him in London the week before at Michael Caine's.
Right.
It was scary.
I bet. That's
everybody was looking at each other all weird, you know. Because that's funny because he said, kill the pigs on the hill. He tried to make it look like black guys did at the Panthers. So he'd get a little racial conflict going there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this country is, whew.
Well, so I guess the biggest health scare of your life probably or at that point, and again, it's chronicled in the doc, but these aneurysms that you had in 74 within a few months of each other, it seems like when you came back from that, which was not at all assured that you would, I mean, it was odds were actually against that, the work seems to have had a different sort of social consciousness after that. Just to mention a few things, you scored Roots in 77, and you won an Emmy for that. 78, you scored The Wiz, even though I know you weren't that enthusiastic about being a part of it,
He told me, you owe me. And I said, you're right.
Yeah.
And I showed up.
Who said that?
Sidney Lumet.
Sidney, right.
Yeah, because I love Sidney, man. He was a great director, man.
So there's another. Then 85 was both We Are the World, of course, and The Color Purple. Do you think that there was a change in your thinking to really be more focused on telling stories and making music that had a social purpose?
No, I was always in that, always, all my life.
Mm-hmm.
When you lose your mother, man, that's all you're doing is looking for signs of making it better.
Mm-hmm. I guess the good thing about doing The Wiz was that was the first crossing of paths with Michael Jackson, right?
Smelly. Yeah.
Can you just to clarify, because people might hear that and
no,
think he was
right.
A smelly guy.
His mother thought I said he smelled bad. No, we were trying to get him to say funk, and he wouldn't say that. Smelly jelly.
Right. In a lot of ways, you were more of a father to him, certainly for a period of his life, than his own father who just
Absolutely.
Died.
Absolutely.
Why do you think you two hit it off?
Well, three things can do that, and that's love, respect, and trust. If you don't have that, nothing's going to happen. And we had both at it, you know, because no one person makes a record. It takes the whole thing.
And he had never done a solo record.
And he was said, I'm going to do this new album on Epic Records. We signed a new deal out outside of Motown, which he helped me find a producer. I said, Michael, I don't even want to talk about that. You don't have a song in the movie yet. Only he's on Down the Road with Diana. And so we finally talked Charlie Smalls into writing You Can't Win with the Crows, you know. And then I started to watch him. And he, after he got all the prosthetics and everything on, with the straw in his chest and everything, he had the ability to know everybody's dialogue, everybody's songs, everybody's dance steps, everything. He didn't miss anything. He was like 19 years old, man.
And so his work ethic is what made you want to believe in him?
And his curiosity.
Yeah.
And so here's what really got me, though. They were at the Brooklyn Hotel one morning with Sidney Lumet rehearsing with the principals, you know. And Michael said, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Confucius, da-da-da-da-da, Kierkegaard, da-da-da-da-da, Socrates. I said, who? And Diana didn't say anything. That was rare. And Sidney didn't say anything. So I went to him and I said, Michael, it's Socrates. It's not Socrates, you know. Come on, man. Really? I said, really? Yeah. And I said, I'd like to take, you look like a deer in a headlight, you know. I said, I'd like to take a shot at it. Let's try it.
With the album. So, and that was.
And that's how we started.
Off the Wall.
Yeah. They went back to the record company and said, Quincy's too jazzy. And so did Barry Gordy. Right. Now, you wouldn't let me work with Marvin or Stevie. You know, Barry's my friend, too, you know. He's right across the hill from me, but he said, no, he's too jazzy. And his father came to me and said, you know, he can't get any bigger, you know. I said, we'll see. I found out a long time ago that the best position to be in this city is to be underestimated. Because if they underestimate you, they get out of your way. And they all used to say, who the hell does Quincy think he is? He's going to try to get a $5.5 million director to direct his first movie. Steven did it for me for $84,000.
When do you think you first learned that lesson about it's good to be underestimated?
During that time.
But even
I'm just saying the movies and making movies and making TV and all that stuff, you know, they get out of your way if they don't think you can do it. And so they say, oh, man, forget it.
Well, so with Michael, obviously it did get a lot bigger, and most of all with Thriller. And so I just wonder, as you look back on that one, the biggest of all albums, why was it so good? What was it that you brought to the table and he brought to the...
But if we had that with all three albums, man.
No,
with
for sure.
My man but... Off the Wall was no slouch, you know. But we went through 800 songs to do Thriller, to get 9. And then at the end of that, the 9, I said quietly, drop all the egos and everything else and say, what relatively are the weakest 4 of those 9? And you have to really be real with yourself for that. And we took out Carousel by Mike Cimbello, who had just had Flashdance and all that, which was close. But I was looking for a really harmonic collage in the song, you know. It was just the opposite of a 3-chord chant like Billie Jean, just 3 chords in that, you know. And so Toto sent over some demos to me. Rod and I left the tape on. We forgot to take it off. And after a while, we heard do-do-do-do-do. Didn't know words. And so we called Mike Cimbello the next day. He wrote the lyrics to it, Human Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so we added Lady in My Life. We wrote PYT with James Ingham and Beat It and Human Nature. man, that set that album on fire because it's architecture when you're sequencing a record, you know, and put that right behind Billie Jean, you know, with just three chords and get it so it's like it's just structure, you know. It's so much fun. You
well,
know?
You've also, you get into details right down to the cover of an album being important, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, and Freddie DeMann and Ron Wise are right with me. I said, no, no, we got to, like he had on a little baby lion and an umbrella. I said, no. Did you see we put him in Bad, the cover of Bad? We had metal and leather jackets and all that macho stuff. You know, it's necessary, man. Because if the cover's messed up, if the songs are wrong, the wrong keys, the wrong tempo, the wrong studio, the wrong engineer, background singers, it's all the producer's fault. If it's a smash, the artist wants to say, I did it all. It's human nature. I understand
right.
that.
Right. People maybe thought because he was so popular and sold, you know, you guys with these albums sold so many records that, you know, it's like years later when Obama was like, the people said, oh, we're in a post-racial America. That idea was quickly out the window. But in the case of Thriller, just to contextualize that for that period, MTV didn't even want to play the video, right?
Pittman was my partner with my joint venture with Time Warner, Steve Ross. He called me in 1980, said, Q, because he was a disc jockey. They called him the Mississippi Hippie. And he said, I've got a great idea. I got seven VJs. What are VJs? Da, 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 da. And all of my content is free because there's promotion, video promotion, you know, and everything else. And I think it's going to work, you know. So he went, he said, I'm going to see the board next week. He was asking for $30 million to try it. And they said, no way, you know, because that was opera singers and we'll call their names. But they said, no way. And so as he left in front of the board there, Steve Ross said, here's $50 million. I believe in it. Let's do it. And at that time, they don't play any black, no black music.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It was
black. And poor Rick James was all messed up with Super Freak. Yeah. They wouldn't do it. And so we were down at Acapulco at the Warner Brothers Villa. And Steve asked me, I said, what is all this stuff about no black music? What is that? Because Pittman's not even close to being a racist, not even close.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a philosophy that went astray. Steve said, what are you releasing next? I said, we're going to double clutch it on Beat It and Billie Jean. He said, Bobby, that goes on next week. It was not Walter Yetnikoff. Trust me, it was Steve Ross. Because we did the video on Billie Jean, and was on MTV, but it really happened in the 25th Motown. That's when it really caught on, and the moonwalk and all that stuff, you know. But by 84, when we released Thriller with Landis, man, that thing took off like nothing I've ever seen in my life. I was at the shoot there. They were trying to talk me out of taking my royalty on that, Landis, you know. And I did. Yeah. And they gave me some footage, which they took back in 6 months.
Right. But so there was never any other music video that you're aware of that was even close to that, right?
Everybody in the world, man. I saw one last year with 13,300 people in Mexico City doing every step together in the town square, you know. It's crazy, man. All over the world, you know.
You referenced a minute ago about working with Spielberg on Color Purple. What was the appeal of producing films?
Because I wanted everybody to see it done with the best, because I loved Alice Walker's book. But it was epistolary, and we had to transform it into a narrative, you know, or a script. And Van Spielberg, it took me 11 months to get him, but he tore it up. He was one of the greatest friends in the world. He used to come to the studio when I was doing Thriller. He was doing E.T. at Laird Studio. I'd go see him. It was smoke in there all the time. You know, he loves that smoke. And the first E.T. was a $700,000 model just controlled by 8 people. But the first one looked too much like a brother, so they had to go back with $700,000 and go back and do another one. That's why he had blue eyes. Because Drew Barrymore was living at our house then.
Color Purple brings up another thing, which is your track record of spotting talent. You found Oprah. You found, essentially, Will Smith and a lot of other
that's
people.
I can't drive, but that's the other thing I can do. I can see the talent in people before they even know they have it.
Well, how do you explain that?
I don't know. I don't even try to explain it. As long as it keeps working. I mean, back to Billy Preston, Brothers right. Johnson, all, you know, Leslie, you know, 16 years old. The rock and roll singers couldn't hear, you know, do 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 do. You know, it's a lot of heavy tonality and ears necessary for that. And she tore it up.
But do you think it's because you had such a broad background yourself in different types of music that you're able to appreciate? I mean,
that's right. And you don't look down on any music, just bad music.
Right.
Yeah.
And so was that the goal of your album that won the Grammy for Album of the Year, where you were essentially taking all of the particularly, I guess you would say, traditionally black music genres, jazz, soul,
yeah,
funk,
all
rap.
People I'd work with. I worked with all of them. Dizzy, Sarah, we did the first record on Misty in 1958 in Paris with Strings, you know. No, they were all close friends. Close friends. And guess what? After that, we had Ella, Sarah, Dizzy, and Miles. Dizzy, Ella, and Sarah. Sarah went straight from the studio and with melanoma and died. Ella died. She had amputated, you know, and I broke my heart because they were my definite idols, you know.
And these were the last.
And then a year later, I finally talked Miles into playing some 11s in Montreux. And 3 months after that, he died. You know, it was heavy.
So that leads into the last few years where I want to ask you about having a documentary made about you. Was the idea of that, if it hadn't been brought to you by your daughter, would you have been as open to the idea, or is there something?
No. No, because when you do something like that, you want to feel safe. And her and the team are the most beautiful people. You know, they're continuously with us, you know, after they did Clark Terry, because Hicks was, he's a drummer.
Well, that's
Aussie.
Let's set it up,
a
though,
drummer,
for our listeners. So you, one of your teachers back in Seattle, early teachers, was Clark Terry.
Yes.
And
12 years old.
And he was still teaching up until a few years ago. And
he taught Miles, too.
Taught Miles, too, and taught Al
East
Hicks.
St. Louis.
You meet Al because you go to meet with Clark while the documentary about Clark is being made.
Yeah, but I went over there to record Snoop Dogg doing hip-hop and him doing mumbles together.
Right.
Because that's been a nice comment. Because a lot of hip-hop comes from jazz, you know, slang, music, everything.
So you then got on board as a executive producer of Keep On Keeping On. Talk about that film and the introduction, you know, you and Al, I mean, that was the beginning of that. And then obviously Al and Rashida did Quincy, but first you had to believe in Al, too.
Well, listen, man, when I hear a drummer come out with a piece like Keep On Keeping On, it blows your mind, man, because, you know, directing is hard. You know, there's a lot of technology going on.
For a first film, too, it's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it's Al got to know you, and I guess Rashida as well, through the Keep On experience. Now they get together and say, we want to do this about you. There had been a couple of attempts to do documentaries about your life, but they hadn't been able to capture in
it's
the way
not,
that this one.
It's not, you know.
Yeah, because there's just so much.
They dug in. They dug in deep.
So they were in your house for years looking through your stuff.
When I go to the bathroom, man, they shoot me.
What's that like? Do you like kind of being
no,
on camera?
I don't like it, but in the hands of people I love and trust, it's another game. It's a whole other trip.
What did you make of the idea that nobody's going to sit down and do what I'm sort of doing now and just throw a bunch of questions at you? Instead, it's going to be all this footage from the past and then just kind of following you in the present. I guess it wasn't really until you saw it when it was done that you understood this was the structure they were taking,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I just trust them.
Right.
I really do. I mean, it's just my heart, you know.
Can you take us into your mind the first time they said, we're ready, we want to show it to you, here's what we've been pouring ourselves into
no,
for the
last... I freaked.
So where was it? Was that your house?
Because they shot, what, 2,000 hours, 800 hours?
Yeah.
To get 2 hours, man. And you know, you can't get all that stuff in there.
What surprised you the most? You were saying that you were reminded of how many close calls you've had, but also what else? I mean,
I don't even know how to start, man. Because it hit everything, you know. Just...
How would you say it made you feel emotionally?
Well, I was flabbergasted at first, you know. And so every time I see it, it's like looking at Keep On Keeping On. That's what I think 15 times. It hits you because just like Keep On Keeping On, there's not a drop of BS in it. Not one drop. They don't play that. But they're real people.
Mm-hmm. And they made a decision that I think is pretty interesting to show your work with the National Museum of African American History and Culture that even after your health scares that you continued to pour yourself into producing that with Don Mischer and the whole giant thing there. The thing that I think people have been coming away from the film amazed by, among other things, is just that you still have the drive to keep doing this.
Right, I'm just starting, baby.
Why is that?
Because I love to create, man. Retired, you take the RE off of that, it's tired, you know? I'm not tired yet.
Right. Does it energize you now over
yes,
these?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
But I mean, specifically,
so get back to work, man.
You were in Toronto. I was in Toronto as well for the film festival a week ago. And there's a big premiere at the Princess of Wales Theater. Yeah. You had a history in Toronto yourself going back a long time.
Yeah, the Massey Hall concert in 52.
So, I mean, it's
the bird.
That was sort of coming home in a way for you, too.
Yeah, we used to party up there, man. Montreal, Quebec, Nova Scotia, come on. Vancouver, 2 hours from Seattle, man.
But now this is going to be the first time back on the 9th, I think it was, of this month, that people were going to see this film about you. Can you describe what it was like for you on that night to come out after the premiere and what sort of response the film and you received there?
Well, I just kind of opened up my soul without any opinions or anything else to just absorb it, inhale it, you know, because of the people involved, man. It's people closer to my soul, you know.
But it's got to be pretty nice to see that both the film and you are being so appreciated, not only in Toronto, but now you've been in New York with it, L.A. for a premiere here as well. I'm sure it's going to go nuts when it goes on Netflix, too. People don't take time that often to appreciate people when they're around. We do tributes of people usually when they're no longer able to feel it. It's got to be kind of nice to be able to feel it.
Yeah, it is. Great. Lucky.
With the last few minutes here, what I wonder if we can do is just talk about the world in which this documentary is coming into. I mean, music today, as opposed to when you were starting out, when you were doing a lot of the things that are chronicled in the documentary. What do you make of music today?
It represents a generation, as all of them do. You know, but I got to tell you, there's a whole crop of young people, including Kendrick Lamar and Chance and da-da-da-da-da, that are something else. Because it really boils down to the same thing that Nadia Boulanger used to tell me all the time. Your music can never be more or less than you are as a human being. So you start to work on the human being.
Do you think it's a good thing that, you know, now there are reality TVs everywhere. You've got things like The Voice and American Idol where somebody's a music star overnight because of that, but they haven't been through the sort of training and learning their craft that you went through. Do you think music suffers because of that?
There's a lot of them that are not on that page at all. Yeah. Have you heard Joey Alexander? He's a little 15-year-old kid that high from Indonesia. Mm-hmm. We played Monterey with him 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. He is frightening. He plays like Herbie Hancock, man, 50-year-old. And that's happening with Andreas. We have 15 kids who we manage and supervise and on the shoulder, you know. You know who the Dirty Loops are? That's a group from Sweden. They are incredible. And Alfredo Rodriguez, Cuban piano player, his father was the biggest singer in Cuba. He practices 14 hours a day, man. That's what it takes to get that left brain ready to apply everything you need. Because you don't have to practice science and emotion. But the science, you have to get your stuff together and know what you're doing.
One thing that I always have wondered and I wanted to ask you is, because of the fact that you've got such a long track record of social consciousness and doing things that are particularly about race, how do you feel when you see the N-word throughout music today, as much as it is?
Yeah, but they're saying more of it than the people outside are saying it. The rappers are saying it all the time. I mean, I go to Sweden and rush in these places, and I hear the Swedish kids talking about nigga, 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 nigga. They don't even know what they're saying, man. They're doing it because the rappers in America did it. I don't think the word diminishes it at all, you know, because the people that mean G-G-E-R still mean that instead of G-G-A. You know, the colloquialist is G-G-A, but G-G-E-R is those people still feel it. And we've been feeling that all our lives, you know. on a road when Lionel Hampton. When you go to the South, you know where you stand because it's up front. White colored drinking fountains and hotel rooms and bus stations and stuff like that. It's a killer, man. It's a killer. And I was from Seattle, you know, which is just the opposite. Garfield High School, that's Jimi Hendrix, Bruce Lee, we all in the same high school. We lived across the street from it. And it was the most diverse one, and the schools in Boston and Seattle were the most diverse schools in America at that time.
How about the overall society with all the work that you have been doing and others, you know, something like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we had the museum that we see you working on in the film and how moving it was to you. But now, 2-3 years later, we have a president who refers to predominantly black countries as shithole countries.
I know.
Does that bother you?
Sure it bothers me, man. Sure it bothers me. And everything he does bothers me. Everything. And he's antagonizing everybody. I mean, the Canadians are our brothers, man. They always have been. I know Trudeau Senior and Junior, you know. They, you know, it's wrong.
The last question is just, why does music matter? I know you clearly think it does.
Why does it matter?
Yeah.
Because the last thing to leave this planet will be music and water. You cannot live without it, brother. How long can you go? Melody is God's voice. Now, I'm sure of that. You know, and it's clothed by lyrics, but it's God's voice. Melody is the power, because there's only 12 notes. Well, we only do it diatonically, so it's something like 8 notes, really. And they've been using that for 710 years. Brahms, Bach, Beethoven, Basie, Bo Diddley, Byrd, everybody. Same 12 notes.
All right, well, I really appreciate this. Thanks for doing it.
You too, man.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.